using nuclear weapons. The government won't confirm that this cyber war is ongoing, but its existence has been widely reported, including new details in the New York Times recently. And according to these reports, Olympic Games was successful, especially in its early days, causing some serious trouble at Iran's main nuclear fuel enrichment facility. Operation Olympic Games is just one of a growing number of cyber war efforts conducted not just by the U.S. and other nations, but also by non-state actors from organized crime to terrorist groups. And that's the worry that two can play at this kind of computer game. So while the U.S. may be engaging in more cyber warfare, those actions may, in turn, make us more vulnerable to counterattacks. Meanwhile, analysts say our defenses in this realm are disturbingly weak, while these threats could have a devastating impact on our everyday lives, damaging vital infrastructure from air traffic control to banking systems to electric grids. Today in The Exchange, a new frontier for conflict in cyberspace. What these threats represent, who's playing offense in this game, and how vulnerable our defenses may be. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. We have two guests joining us from the D.C. area is Siobhan Gorman, intelligence correspondent, who's written a lot about this subject for The Wall Street Journal. And Siobhan, really nice to have you. Thanks for your time.
Good to be with you.
Also with us in studio, Bill Martell, Associate Professor of International Security Studies at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University and author of the book Victory in War. And Bill, always good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Laura.
Well, Bill, earlier this year, FBI Director Robert Mueller warned that while terrorism is still his department's top priority, quote, in the not too distant future, we anticipate the cyber threat will pose the number one threat to our country. What's he talking about here, Bill, when he says cyber threat? What does that cover?
Well, Laura, what's interesting is that in the last 15 years, a debate has begun to emerge both in the government, the national security community, and, of course, in the media on this issue called cyber. And cyber means all the things that occur on internet-based on the internet. So email communication, internet, much of our electric power grid, much of our critical infrastructure, lots of stuff on the national security front all exist on this, on the internet. And so quickly, people, quickly realized that as powerful as this was, it provides a weapon. And it provides it creates enormous vulnerabilities. So beginning in the mid-90s, people began to be aware of this. It then became accelerated with Y2K when we moved from the year to year 2000. People worried about various catastrophes. And it's become only increasingly important. And I would note that people like Siobhan, among others, have been writing about this in the media for at least the last 6, 7, 8 years, and it has become what many in the national security, foreign policy, and media establishments consider to be the most critical issue facing the country. And this is not stuff, this can be very techie stuff, but from the point of view of policy and public interest, these are issues that directly affect the lives, the survival, the livelihood and prosperity of every American, and frankly, most people anywhere in the globe because of this ubiquitous, all-connected kind of internet.
We forget that our infrastructure, Bill, is so heavily linked to computers.
I always point out that if you use internet, email, water, power, light, banking, finance, all those things are intimately, directly connected to the internet, all of which are potential targets for people, both states, as you pointed out, Laura, and what we call non-state actors or extremists or other groups that want to basically attack and weaken societies.
Well, Siobhan, add in, what are we really watching out for here?
Well, I think Bill makes a lot of good points, and one of the things that can be very difficult in trying to understand how real the cyber threat is that there have been actually a number of indicators that this threat is emerging. It's just that it kind of remains invisible because a lot of it is still, people, particularly other countries, getting into systems where they should not be, that we rely on quite a bit. It's just that oftentimes they're going in and they're doing a lot of surveillance of these systems. For example, the U.S. found evidence a few years ago that people in China and Russia were doing surveillance of the computer networks that run all kinds of components of the U.S. electric grid. A little bit later, U.S. investigators found that someone had broken into the NASDAQ exchange. But we haven't seen the actual physical effects yet, which is why it still doesn't seem real to people. But there's a lot of electronic evidence that is mounting that suggests that there are people who are trying to break into these computer systems. And it's kind of like someone breaking into your house but not really stealing anything, just kind of scoping out to figure out what's there to perhaps come back later and take the good stuff.
Still, it's kind of creepy, and that's a great analogy, Siobhan. So surveillance by China and Russia of the U.S. electric grid. Yeah, that doesn't make me feel really good.
Right. That's how a lot of particularly U.S. intelligence officials feel. And, there are a lot of other really important things that are also connected to the Internet: air traffic control, subway systems, all kinds of train systems. Most things that use computers to get around and do their business are in some way or another directly or indirectly connected to the Internet these days.
Well, and there's two parts to this game, offense and defense. And I definitely want to talk about offense with both of you because of the recent attack on Iran's nuclear processing facility. But let's talk defense first, Bill Martell. From what all I've read, security analysts are extremely worried that our defenses are not very good in this area. Pretty shabby, actually.
Yeah, I'd break it into two camps, if you will, two groups. There's the governmental side, the national security side, and I think a reasonable hypothesis is that people are working hard to make us more resilient, more less vulnerable. But no one that I know would argue that any organization is absolutely totally invulnerable or immune to attack unless there are no internet connections, no computer connections into that particular organization or group. And it's very hard to find those examples. The other side, and so there's a lot of work going on there. And
so on the government side, we're doing okay.
Yes. I think I'd say that people are alert to the problem and are pouring lots and lots of money into it. I think I've heard recently that of all the areas that were going to be affected are going to be cut in national security. The rumor mill has it that probably cyber will not. That's so important, and so much of what we use depends upon that. On the private sector side, the example that I use for people to put this in sharp relief, most of the United States, and if you think about your local grocery store or other shop places that you visit, they have about a long weekend's worth of supplies. That is 3-4 days of the meats, the fish, the dairy products. But all of those, that entire supply distribution network, I'm not even thinking for a moment, we'll get to it with natural gas and oil and all that stuff, all of that is operated on on computer networks. So on the private sector side, I think the consensus I hear, and Siobhan, I'm sure, will weigh in here, is that it's probably more vulnerable on the private sector side. Now, the potential countervailing fact is that the private sector really depends upon maintaining commerce and they have a very strong interest in making sure that this is not vulnerable. But I think the sense I get is that the government side is known to be vulnerable, but people really are thinking about that. Private sector side is probably more vulnerable.
Well, it's bigger and more diffuse. And Siobhan, I wonder what you've been finding out in your reporting about the defense that the U.S. has, whether in the government sector, national security, or something as simple as, our food system.
Well, on the government side, probably the most protected systems, you won't be surprised to learn, are the classified systems, although those have seen breaches as well. There was a 2008 breach that the Pentagon later acknowledged had gotten into classified systems at Central Command. And that was actually a real wake-up call for the Pentagon. There are unclassified systems throughout government that get compromised quite frequently. So the government is doing better in that it is focused on the problem and it appreciates the extent of the problem, because it's your classic weakest link problem, that if 98% of the network is protected, that's great, but any persistent hacker is going to find those 2% spots where you can penetrate. And the problem is that usually once you're in these networks, you can get to lots of other places that maybe the people who created the network didn't even realize were actually connected. And so that's the real concern. On the private sector side, the frustration that I hear both from cybersecurity specialists as well as folks in the government government is that it's just incredibly spotty, and often companies, while their livelihoods do rely on just-in-time delivery and a lot of computerized processes, the very top-level management doesn't see it as doesn't see the risk of cyber attack to their company as being all that high, and they don't necessarily appreciate that it might be higher than they think, and it could actually they could be indirectly affected by cyber attacks on somebody else, or they could indirectly facilitate cyber attacks on somebody else. I mean, there have been widespread attacks, maybe not attack, but infiltrations of people's bank account and theft through a lot of the third-party ACH transfer organizations. So people were seeing their bank accounts at, you know, very large banks penetrated, not through an attack on, you know, the bank itself, but through the organizations that were doing the money transfers. And so a lot of these things are just there are a lot of connections that are indirect but could end up ultimately still affecting you.
Bill, did you want to jump in?
I would just add one thought. One of the things I hear is routinely is that almost any organization in the private sector, banking, finance, insurance, et cetera, are attacked on a daily basis. And when they're successful, what is rumored is that the people who make those successful penetrations into those security systems will later go back and say to the firm, we've identified a flaw in your security, and for a consulting fee, we can fix this sort of thing.
And that doesn't sound like a cyber attack, though. I think of a cyber attack as, you know, Russians going into the electric grid here in the U.S., like Siobhan said.
Well, but think about the potential of a cyber attack in a more indirect sense. Company X is in the news, has been massively attacked in a cyber sense. It's going to affect stock prices. It's going to affect consumer confidence. And they really don't want that. The people in the private sector don't want any of this discussion going on, and try to keep this, as I say, away from prying eyes.
All right. Well, lots more to talk about after a short break. Our phone number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. We'll be right back.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and more on the age of cyber warfare on the exchange on NHPR and at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, Economic Pressures on Local Governments. New Hampshire weather today, mostly sunny with highs 82 to 87 degrees. Tonight, turning partly to mostly cloudy, lows from 55 from the White Mountains north, ranging to 65 degrees in southern areas of the state. Tomorrow, clouds, some sunshine, scattered showers and thunderstorms possible. High temperatures tomorrow, 80 to 85 degrees. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the NEEF Network Organizations, a statewide leader assisting students and parents planning for college. Information at nhheaf.org. And Dr. Rod Burdett and Riverview Dental of Concord, dedicated to enhancing your appearance, oral health, and wellness. The practice that listens. SmilesNH.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the growth of cyber sabotage and cyber attacks and how the U.S. has been playing the game. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477. Have you experienced the effects of cyber attack at your business? Overall, what aspects of New Hampshire life do you think might be most vulnerable in this area, whether our water infrastructure, our electric grid, our nuclear power plants? Also, who should pay for beefing up our cyber defenses? As we've been hearing, they are not as strong as they could be. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. Also, The Exchange is now on Facebook, so we hope you'll go to our page. Join the conversation there. One more time, the phone number is 1-800-892-6477. And Siobhan Gorman, before we go to the phones, I did want to ask you, because you've written about this, there's some conflict in Washington about who should pay to help the private sector beef up its cyber defenses. Everybody wants the nuclear power plant and the electric power plant and, you know, the water processing facility to be safe, but who wants to pay for it?
Well, that is a big debate, and actually perhaps even less about money but more over control. And the main debate going on Capitol Hill right now, which may sort of come to the Senate floor later this month, is how much control the U.S. government and, in particular, the Department of Homeland Security should have when it comes to making requirements that the private sector meet certain cybersecurity standards. And that's a sort of a multi-part issue in Washington. The main battle is really over how much government can require of the private sector, but there's also sort of a secondary battle in Washington over whether the Department of Homeland Security is the right organization to be doing that, or whether the National Security Agency should be more involved because they're actually the ones that have the best data on what mechanisms are being used to infiltrate systems and things like that.
Are you saying, Siobhan, that there are turf wars in Washington? I'm shocked, shocked, shocked.
I'm sure you're shocked to learn that, but it's interesting in the cybersecurity realm because for a number of years it had actually been a pretty bipartisan issue, and in the last couple of years, as has happened with many issues, cybersecurity has become a pretty intensely partisan debate, largely over kind of the notion of government regulation.
So it's not so much, Siobhan, an issue of who should pay for it, but how much information is shared and who has control? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. I think that the who should pay for it question almost comes after you figure out who's levying what kinds of requirements, because the requirements will determine the cost. And in at least so far in Washington, I don't know that there's that much. I just haven't heard as much discussion over who should pay.
All right.
That would come. It's just kind of a second order issue.
I've got a question for you on that too, Bill, but let's go to our callers. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email us if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. And first up from Dover is Joshua. Hi, Joshua. Thanks for joining us. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good.
I work professionally in the cybersecurity realm, and I'd like to maybe slightly recharacterize things about offense and defense in private sector and public sector. For many years now, including Secretary Chertoff when he was in his position, would say that all the expertise in cyber is in the private sector and that they needed a public-private partnership to get the private sector to lead the way. And yet, if you understand things like tragedy of the commons, the private sector is highly optimized for things like protecting credit card numbers and profitability, and has really neglected less replaceable asset defense like critical infrastructure, power grids, national security data. So what you see in general is the U.S. and its adversaries have incredibly talented adversarial or offensive capabilities, but very, very, very poor defensive capabilities for ourselves and for them. The difference is, in general, the U.S. has more to lose than many of its adversaries.
Yeah, and I've definitely read, Joshua, that while our offense is pretty good, our defense is not. So what do you think the way out is, Joshua? I know that's a huge question, but given your expertise, I'm curious.
Well, there's been a bit of a wake-up call in the last 2 years. We've had more than a breach a week in the private sector and public sector. You saw fairly untalented but motivated hacktivist groups like Anonymous basically attacking any target they wanted at will successfully. So there's a lot of new conversation about how do we look deeper at those problems. But we should certainly not carry a false sense of security that we're doing a decent job. I think it's more about figuring out for which adversaries we have, what we need to do differently to shore up and not look for linear growth, but step function growth. So some pretty radical discussions need to happen and less turf war.
Wow, Joshua, thanks for calling in. And boy, so good to hear from him, Bill Martell, given his expertise.
What's really interesting from Josh, that was a really great set of comments, Joshua. What's very interesting to me, what jumped out at me from your remarks is what we were talking about several minutes ago. This is not uncommon. This is occurring all the time. And his comment about a major breach per week. And then my question to all your listeners is, how many have heard of those? And one of the reasons you don't hear about it is this, and I well understandable pressure on the private sector not to let this stuff out because it will affect the confidence that consumers have generally in the economy and more specifically in that particular company. And we haven't even talked the infrastructure side in any detailed sense. So this is something that, as Siobhan pointed out and others are pointing out, this is really big issue. It is changing how the foreign policy, national security, and infrastructure communities. When we use the word infrastructure, we mean power, oil, gas, water, all the things that you need, each of us need on a daily basis to survive. One final thought. You are seeing on a very minor scale the effects of an attack, which could be cyber, which in this case is an electric, is a storm. When we're looking at places like Maryland, Washington, Virginia, West Virginia, they are suffering. It's worse in some areas. But imagine in your life going without power for several days or weeks, not in July, but in January. This is the reason that people on variety of in organizations and fronts, both in the government and outside the government, are really, really nervous about this stuff.
You know, I'm interested in Joshua's point, Siobhan, that individual businesses have their individual concerns. And yet when it comes to cybersecurity, we all kind of need to hold hands and sing kumbaya and figure this out. I thought that was real interesting.
Yeah, it is an interesting point, and that's actually the argument that people make when they say that there is a role for the U.S. government, especially when it comes to things like critical infrastructure, to try to ensure that certain basic cybersecurity standards are met. Because, you know, if you look at something like the electric grid, it's got so many different components, and so even if a major power company, say PG&E, is doing a great job, if all of the other distribution companies and others that are linked up to it are not, then the whole system starts to fall apart a little bit if there's a cyber infiltration. So that is one of the major debates going on in Washington over the role of government. Just one other point on what Joshua said, because he made a good point about sort of defense versus offense. And what you're starting to hear in Washington anyway is a little bit more discussion about whether more offense actually gives you better defense. It's the notion of how do you apply deterrence theory in cyberspace, and that is very difficult when it's a very opaque thing, as Bill has pointed out several times. People don't have a sense of how often these attacks are happening and how they're being perpetrated. And so until there's a little bit more public discussion about who is doing what to whom in cyberspace, it's very hard to even get to things like deterrence, which some policymakers in Washington think could be a significant component to addressing the problem.
Let's take some more of your calls. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Join us as we look at the growing threat of cyber sabotage, cyber attacks. Do you agree with assessments that this is the number one emerging threat to our nation, as the head of the FBI said recently? Also, who should pay for beefing up our cyber defenses? And where do you think New Hampshire might be vulnerable in this area? Our number, 1-800-892-6477. And Siobhan Gorman and Bill Martell, let's take another call. This is Michael in Portsmouth. Hi, Michael. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm really concerned about nuclear power plants and the power grid. I mean, I've read that a solar storm could knock out the power grid, and if the power grid was out long enough, then the power plants, the nuclear power plants, couldn't keep cool. So I'm just wondering what would happen for an extended period if cyber terror did that.
Yeah, and we saw what happened in Japan, Bill, when they couldn't keep the cooling facilities cool at the power plant there on the coast of Japan. Thank you.
Michael, great, great question. I would expand it. So everybody's concerned about nuclear power, electric power, all those forms of that element of the infrastructure. But it applies to all the dimensions that exist in all the things that every one of us uses every day to survive. An issue that really brought this, I think we were talking about this earlier, an issue that brought this front and center to the attention of the U.S. and both the public and the government were reports that Siobhan wrote back, I think in 2009, Siobhan, was it?
Yeah, that was 2009.
On Russia and China being able to penetrate the American electric power grids. Now, that doesn't just include oil-fired or gas-fired or coal-fired, or it includes all the above, including nuclear. So this is something that, and after 9/11, with what we saw on that horrible day, one of the issues that increased in the U.S. was paying very careful attention to the infrastructure side of this equation. And that's why this remains such an important issue. And it's something that really is unfamiliar to most of what people think about in the U.S. I remember a star at a meeting in Cambridge a few years ago talking about cyber, and someone observed that there was a fellow from China who wanted to come to the United States to study and to do, quote, his doctorate in the cyber vulnerabilities of the American power grid. And the reaction of people here was, well, we don't really do that in computer science. You really focus more generally. He said, well, that's very interesting. He said, I just finished my master's in China and studying the cyber vulnerabilities of the American electric power grid system. So, Michael, this is the tip of the iceberg that has so many people communities concerned. And I'm not trying to be alarmist. I'm just saying this is what the debate is going on around the country, around the world, actually.
Here's a flip side, though, to that question about beefing up our infrastructure to protect it from cyber attack. And Siobhan, I'll throw this to you. I wonder if this big concern that you hear from Washington about cybersecurity becomes an excuse for government to spend more money, perhaps unnecessarily. After 9/11, there was a lot of government spending under the headline of Homeland Security. And then when people dug into it, you know, they found out that, you know, cattle farmers in rural Nebraska were getting Homeland Security grants, for example. So I wonder if this has the potential to become a boondoggle, especially given how complicated it is. And, you know, most people don't really understand it. So they say, yeah, I want to be safe. And yeah, I don't want to be blamed. And so here's the money.
I think that that is certainly a legitimate question. And particularly in this economic climate, there will be a greater concern just because the impact of wasteful spending is certainly higher when there's a sense that there's just far less money to go around. I think that it's very hard to completely guard against that, but you know, a lot of the discussions that I hear really so far have had less to do with money, because I think that the expectations are that a lot of this is held in the private sector, and so companies would, for the most part, be required to spend that money themselves on their company, and in theory, then would have an incentive to, not spend it wastefully. On the government side, there is always that risk. And, there are often concerns that once you start hiring a lot of defense contractors to start implementing something, their incentive is to just kind of create more billable hours for the next project. So that is a classic problem that won't be unique to cybersecurity, but certainly, you've seen a lot of the defense consulting firms in Washington really beef up their cybersecurity divisions or outright buy companies to create cybersecurity divisions, as Boeing did not too long ago, because they are thinking that this is going to be big business for them. So it's certainly something to keep an eye on.
Now, what do you think, Bill? You know, wrap yourself in the flag of cybersecurity and spend away.
Here's the dilemma, and present this to your listeners. And both sides of this dilemma are absolutely compelling, and you can argue them either way convincingly. Argument one is the government has to be involved in providing some sort of basic infrastructure security, some sort of cybersecurity to protect all the things that are on which our survival as a country exists, depends. And it's very hard to argue against that. Let me give you the counterargument. If you have, in fact, government-established protocols, approaches, programs, whatever you want to call it, to provide that basic security infrastructure, you have then standardized the whole system against an attack. So if everybody is operating on the same basis of security, the government says, you will use all critical infrastructure, all government agencies will use this particular set of programs to protect yourselves against cyber attacks. What if somebody penetrates those kinds of programs?
So you need sort of
you on the one hand,
not duplication. You need everybody using a different system.
But if you do that, then you have no standardization of protection.
And highly inefficient.
So, and this has been one of the debates, is that if I establish standards and everybody adheres to them,
right,
and somebody breaks those standards, we're doomed. I mean, then everything is open to attack. But if there are no standards, then, of course, the whole discussion we've been having on the vulnerabilities we face is right in our faces, as Michael pointed out, and as Joshua pointed out, that offense-defense nexus.
Well, I want to thank both of them for those calls. And again, you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. Your questions, comments, concerns about the emerging threat of cybersecurity being talked a lot about today by security officials in Washington. Our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And Siobhan and Bill, let's turn from defense to offense. And Siobhan, this is an area where I gather the U.S. has been pretty aggressive lately.
Yes, it's something that the U.S. pretty much in the last, maybe not quite decade, but nearly that, I think really started to appreciate, particularly at the Defense Department and National Security Agency and the Central Intelligence Agency, which also plays a very key role in some of this, just as the U.S. is dependent on a lot of these systems, so are a number of our adversaries. And you know, anything that you can do to penetrate what is known in the spy world as a hard target, something like Iran, something like North Korea, remotely without having to actually physically be there is certainly worth pursuing. And so you've seen a buildup both in terms of offensive and defensive measures in the U.S. really since at least 2006, 2007. In early 2009, the Bush administration finally acknowledged, this was like the final days of the Bush administration, that they had launched what was known as the Comprehensive Cybersecurity Initiative. But that had been a couple years in the making. And that was basically a huge push both to develop cyber weapons that could both surveil and, you know, do damage to adversaries' networks, as well as starting to try to build up the defense, which is obviously what we've also talked a lot about this morning.
Well, and Exhibit A, Bill, was that story that I referenced at the beginning of the hour, right? The attacks, the cyber attacks on Iran's nuclear program. I have a broader question for you about that, but just first remind us how much damage this cyber effort made to Iran's nuclear capabilities.
The first serious reporting on this occurred several years ago, and it was called the Stuxnet. And it's, by public reports, a virus, a computer virus. It's a cyber weapon. It's a cyber attack. And it was used against the Iranian nuclear complex, and in particular against their centrifuges. And without getting too technical about it, because I'm not really a technical person, but what I've been briefed on and what I've heard about is that it interfered with the control mechanisms running these centrifuges. And as I know a number of your listeners know, when you're trying to build nuclear weapons, you need highly enriched uranium, and one of the ways you generate that is just spin it in these centrifuges to get to create highly enriched uranium. And this interfered with those centrifuges. Public reporting was it did extraordinary damage to thousands of centrifuges in Iran. And at the time, the public reporting, both Times, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, among others, was that this was a very elegant, very sophisticated weapon because it did extraordinary damage. It severely damaged the Iranian nuclear program, probably put it back several years.
Wow. So, well, and I have another question for both of you coming out about how these types of uses of cyber warfare are redefining notions of what is conflict, what is war. So we'll talk about that after a short break and take more of your calls. So stay with us at 1-800-892-6477.
I'm Virginia Prescott. Right now at wordofmouthradio.org, a certified font nerd on the emotional power of typefaces.
There's one called Papyrus. It has a sort of a slightly battered look, like it might be contained in a scroll.
It's sort of saying, we're classy, but classic.
Yeah.
That story and so much more online now at wordofmouthradio.org.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from New Hampshire Orthopedic Center, keeping bodies in motion, on the web at nhoc.com. And the Mo Washington Auto Road, located on Route 16 in Pinkham Notch, where you can live free and drive to the world above treeline. mtwashingtonautoroad.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, for the 4th of July holiday, we bring you our earlier Socrates Exchange, examining the question, who is American? Be sure to join us tomorrow morning at 9 for that special broadcast. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at countries and companies spying and battling in cyberspace. Join us with your questions or comments at 1-800-892-6477. Have you experienced or looked at the effects of cyber attack in your business or industry? What aspects of life here in New Hampshire do you think might be most vulnerable? Do you agree with top government officials that cyber war is the emerging number one threat to our nation? The head of the FBI said that recently. Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Your questions and comments are welcome at 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. And Siobhan and Bill, let's go right back to the callers. From Ringe, Hallel is calling. Hi, Hallel, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I'm a big fan of your show. So I just wanted, and I came into the show late, so I might have missed this, but I was hoping maybe the guests could talk about my opinion that we over-rely on cyber technology and that that use of cyber technology is related to fossil fuel consumption, and maybe it's a positive thing for folks to kind of, you know, maintain different technologies and kind of stay in touch with their local communities not using cyber technology.
So live off the grid, Hillel.
Well, yeah, and there was the author, Jeremy Rifkin, who talked about the third industrial revolution with smart grids like solar and wind and how that's linked to the Internet. And, you know, if a cyber threat kind of hijacked that kind of grid, it might be a whole different scenario than, you know, fossil fuel. And frankly, you know, that the government would need to take over control of responsibility for cyber is, I would like to hear the guests talk about that.
Okay, Hillel, good point. And, you know, I got to say, Siobhan, one that I had not thought of, but I have heard a lot over the years about more movement toward not just eating local, but producing power locally, for example, and just kind of living more local, focusing more on micro economies. He's right. You know, if you were producing power from a wind turbine on the top of your house, you wouldn't need to worry about this, would you?
That's certainly true. The question is, how sustainable is it? And certainly in some circumstances, you could create, you know, sort of your own little micro environment, kind of a smaller town society. I think that the challenge is that a lot of times people don't realize how many things that they do that are connected to the Internet that they just don't think about. So, you know, if you want to choose to live without a cell phone and, you know, producing your own electricity, that's fine. You know, if you go to the grocery store, maybe you can go to local farmers market. I don't know. For people who can make that work, that may well help. I think that the broader concern that people have kind of from the policy side is that most of America isn't going to do that. And there are kind of larger national security concerns if you talk about vulnerabilities to critical infrastructure. I mean, water power plants and dams and things like that. So even if you can kind of live largely off the grid, if you live near some sort of water source and someone's able to tamper with the dam and let that water flow, you still may be stuck with a flood. So I'm not sure, given our interconnected society, that anyone can fully pull out anymore, but that's an interesting philosophical question.
Yeah, hello. Thanks a lot for calling in, Bill. What do you think?
Hello, that's a really interesting question, and I have to say I'm really optimistic in that regard, and I'll tell you why. Is many of the people who are working in the trenches on the information technology argue we're on what is called an exponential growth curve, that whatever micro processors can do, computer chips can do now, they will do a lot better next year, a lot better the year after that, and we're on this accelerating curve, and we on this exponential curve, which means tremendous growth, and we've been on it for several decades. So why? The reason I'm very optimistic, Hillel, is that what you're suggesting is that once this information revolution begins to really plant itself in American society and, frankly, on a global scale, there is no limit to what people are going to come up with for ideas that will generate brand new ways of generating power, processing power, storing power. It's all of this plays to our advantage. And here's an example that I'd give you. Whatever cell phone you have today is not nearly is much better than the one you had a year ago. And you know that if you wait a year, it'll be even better still. We're seeing that in every dimension of the economy. To Siobhan's point about how much we use the information system, imagine operating without the Internet or email for a day. And people talk about sort of going offline, just, you know, disconnecting for a day, and it's unthinkable, actually. I'm kidding. I'm slightly kidding here. That's the revolution that is changing virtually every facet of our lives, and that's why I'm very optimistic that however we're generating power now or however we're operating the infrastructure today is likely going to be much better, much more efficient in the year from now or 2 years or 5 years from now. Now, what others will say is, as that happens, our vulnerability to cyber probably increases. So we have this offense-defense race that's occurring now in trying to use the stuff more effectively, but also not dig ourselves into a hole with being vulnerable.
Hello, thanks a lot for that point. And you can join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. cyberwar.org. And Bill and Siobhan, you know, we talked earlier about that recent cyber attack called Olympic Games, a broad series of cyber sabotage and cyber attacks on Iran's nuclear networks. And, you know, Siobhan, to you first, but Bill, definitely to you too. This has raised questions about what is war, what is conflict. When the U.S. government works through cyberspace to destabilize another government, as with that Iran example, at what point, Siobhan, is that an act of war? I mean, if we went in and bombed that Iranian facility, it would certainly be seen as an act of war. So what about disabling it through a computer virus?
It's a very important question, and interestingly, this is something that the Pentagon and other policymakers in Washington have been struggling with for years, the notion of what is an act of war in cyberspace. And what what they're defaulting to until they come up with something better is an act of war in cyberspace looks like an act of war anywhere else. So if it causes enough damage for one of the parties in this conflict to declare war or declare it to be a war, then you may well find yourself going down that path. And I think that so far it's actually, as we've seen with the Stuxnet and Olympic Games examples, it's not in the U.S. interest to maybe even be really clear about what constitutes an act of war in cyberspace, because what Stuxnet and Olympic Games were within the sort of U.S. legal definition is a covert action. It was something that was done under CIA authority, and it was a covert action, just like the bin Laden raid was a covert action, just like, technically, even though it's a very open secret, drone attacks in Pakistan are a covert action. So those, it's a political decision, what is an act of war? And I think that in the cyber realm, it's still very unclear, and to some degree it's to the U.S. advantage to have it be that way, because we are at least among the countries that's at the forefront of developing these kinds of cyber weapons and probably don't want to see our hands tied, before we really get a sense of where all of this is going.
It must make it very hard, by the way, Siobhan, for you to report on this, right? I mean, it's all so, well, we don't want to give you that information. What do you think, Bill? This is right up your alley. I mean, again, your book is Victory in War. Where do you draw the line as someone who studies war with this particular attack on Iran's nuclear facility? Is that an act of war, even though no American boot ever touched the ground?
That's a great point. And to Siobhan's excellent comments, I'd pose the following dilemma for your listeners. You're sitting in a meeting. You're a government policy type, and someone comes in and says to you, "We have two options for dealing with Iran. Option one, with a nuclear program. Option one is attack it with air power and rip the complex apart, and it would be highly effective. Outcome's pretty clear, but it's an act of war. Option two is, and you can't in the first case with using air power, you really can't deny that you did it. I mean, it'll be pretty obvious, pretty fast. Option two is we can maybe have the same effect, but not use airplanes, probably not kill people, probably not have any, and the term of art, I'm sure Siobhan hears this on a daily basis, is plausible deniability. I can plausibly deny that.
Who us?
So now picture, how would you, as a policymaker, how would you want to deal with this?
It almost seems too good to be true.
It is. And so then the problem becomes, if we take the cyber option, which apparently, according to press reports, the U.S. has, are we now saying to the world, it is perfectly legitimate to attack countries using cyber as a weapon? And if we've legitimized that, I'm not saying we should or shouldn't, I have my own views on this, then the second question is, if it's okay for states to do this, what about non-state terrorist actors, extremist groups? Is it legitimate for them to attack both themselves and us and other countries and organizations and societies? So we're sitting right on the edge of a moment where people are declaring the cyber weapon is unbelievable. It just gives us tremendous capabilities, but it leaves no fingerprints by and large. And then you have to say, do you really want the world moving in a direction where they can settle disputes and grievances using cyber weapons? It is a conundrum of the highest order. And as Siobhan pointed out, and so many have pointed out, the policy communities, the legal communities, the national security communities, the military intelligence, private sector are all wondering, what do we do next? Where does this all this? How does this evolve?
Well, the United Nations recently talked about this. Can we make cyberspace a conflict-free zone? I read that and I thought, okay, I don't want to be cynical, but good luck with that, given how useful that tool was for the United States with Iran. But here's a question for you, Siobhan, stemming from what Bill said, you know, does the U.S. government invite retaliation by enemy countries or enemy groups by doing what it apparently did in Iran? Or are those countries and groups, you know, already trying to destabilize us using cyber warfare? So, you know, what the heck? I mean, we're not really giving them further incentive. They're already interested in this. What do you think?
Well, there are a couple things on that. Most directly, at least since the Stuxnet virus was discovered, which I think was in 2010, and there were some indications maybe it kind of came up earlier, but it really kind of came, people became more aware of it in 2010. Most people assumed that the U.S. And or Israel had a hand in it. And so it's the latest revelations don't necessarily automatically kind of shift the playing field, but it does show sort of this conundrum that the world has increasingly found itself in recent years. In some reporting that I did back in 2009 on penetrations of the electric grid, one of the things that really alarmed U.S. intelligence officials was that they had not only found evidence of Chinese and Russian surveillance, but also evidence that they had put little pieces of software in the electric grid that would allow them to remotely cause destruction in the future if they so chose.
Really? Someone in Moscow or Beijing could push a button and, you know, hurt the electric grid here in New England?
Yes, that was the idea. And so, you know, there were questions at that time. Well, is that an act of war? If we saw Chinese or Russian agents running around Washington, D.C., planting little bombs but not detonating them and having the capability to detonate them at some time in the future, how would we feel about that? So it's, you know, it's a very tricky area, and a lot of it is going to be very situationally dependent. And in the case of Iran, you know, obviously we've been engaged in a low-grade conflict with Iran for quite some time, and the U.S. has been engaging in a range of sabotage efforts, of which Olympic Games is one of them. And it at one level, cyberspace is just it's a battleground just like everything else, and that's kind of increasingly what you hear in places like the Pentagon is, well, the same rules that apply in the rest of the terrestrial world, you know, also apply in cyberspace. And to some degree that's going to be true, but I think increasingly we're starting to see how there are more novel elements, like not being able to have any fingerprints, so there, you know, almost complete deniability, at least for some period of time, that do make cyberspace a little different. And I think that that's what's really tripping people up.
And again, you mentioned the Stuxnet virus, Siobhan. Just in case people joined us later, that was again the virus that caused havoc at Iran's main nuclear fuel enrichment facility, that most people think the U.S. did it with the help of Israel, even though both governments are denying it. Is that right? That's what the Stuxnet virus was?
That is, although it's pretty well confirmed that the U.S. and Israel were behind it.
Just trying to be accurate there, because, again, they don't want to say right out, right, Siobhan, that they did this.
No one's acknowledged it. No one's acknowledged it.
Bill.
And they won't.
And that's right. And people, the last 5, 6, 7 years, people have been arguing that in terms of war, that you can do as much damage to a society. This will sound very controversial, but it's nonetheless true. You can do as much human damage to a society with cyber attacks, if properly executed, as you could do minus physical damage with a nuclear attack. I mean, if you attacked the United States in a serious way in the middle of winter and you had to go for several months without electric power, the casualties would be extraordinary. And that could be the modern form of warfare that we all have to confront. And that's why people are so worried about it. That's why all the discussions are going on. How do we better protect ourselves? Should the government be involved? Should the government spend money to help protect us? What should the private sector do? Everyone is worrying about this sort of thing. And again, this is not your listeners shouldn't go away and be deeply worried. It's something that societies are good, we're pretty good at figuring these things out, and we're probably better than others. On the offense side, I think I'd also point to that in terms of this issue of war, one of the things I think that one of the factors that restrains this whole issue is people, if you attack another country, you're not quite sure what it can do until you find out. And so there is a sense of deterrence. I think countries are nervous about attacking the U.S. because they don't quite know what we could do in response, and they probably assume it's pretty good. So there is a level of we are deterring people by the reputation the U.S. has.
By keeping our offense up. That reminds me of the 60s, 70s, 80s, mutually assured destruction, right? We had all these nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
Soviet Union had all these nuclear weapons, and there was the hope that I won't light mine if you won't light yours.
You attack me, if you attack me, you die, and if I attack you, I die. So
okay, we have terrorist groups who have different value systems.
They don't have infrastructure. They don't have targets. They exist as virtual organizations operating across the Internet. And if they had the ability, one presumes they probably would attempt to attack this. If your viewers go out and go out and Google CNN, and there's an image of a electric power generator that was destroyed by a cyber attack, and it physically destroys itself. Google it; you can find it. It's fascinating.
All right. Well, both of you, this has been enlightening, a little disconcerting, but thank you very much, both of you, for joining us. Siobhan, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
That's Siobhan Gorman, intelligence correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, joining us from the D.C. area. Bill Martell, always great to see you. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Laura. Thank you.
Bill Martell, associate professor of international security studies at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. Bill's book is called Victory in War. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. A volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange is now on Facebook. Become a fan of our page. You can learn more about upcoming shows, what we're planning, get extra links and material. Our executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoi, and tomorrow on The Exchange, for the 4th of July, we bring you our earlier Socrates Exchange, examining the question, who is American? Is it simply a matter of birthright and legal status? Or is it a state of mind, a certain spirit or attitude? Join us for this special Socrates Exchange. That's tomorrow morning at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.